Morning, everybody. On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. If it's true that every person has a story, is it also true that every city has one too? What is Baltimore's story? What narratives have emerged after the cataclysmic events following the death of Freddie Gray? And what do those narratives tell us about Baltimore's identity? A new series called Baltimore Stories, Narratives in the Life of an American City has answers. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland and Phoebe Stein from the Maryland Humanities Council give us a preview. Then Eddie Glaude from Princeton University says that for African Americans, huge gaps in values and opportunity are pernicious and longstanding, and the reason black politics needs to be transformed. We'll talk about his new book, Democracy in Black. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the new show at the Single Carrot Theater. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Good morning. Glad you're with us. In just 5 weeks, we will reach the one-year anniversary of the violence and uprising that crippled Baltimore after the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died while in police custody last April. Freddie Gray is now very much part of the story of Baltimore, a story that was reported nationally with varying degrees of accuracy and which has, without doubt, informed our image of ourselves as well as the image our city projects in the wider world. The ramifications of Freddie Gray's death for the city of Baltimore are many, as are ideas about the ways in which the city can and should respond to improve the conditions that led to the unrest. One of those ideas is to explore how Baltimore's sense of identity is informed by the narratives that have emerged after last year's violence. The University of Maryland Arts and Humanities Center for Synergy has teamed up with the Maryland Humanities Council, the UMBC Drescher Center and Imaging Research Center, the Enoch Pratt Library, and the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance to think about the role of narrative in our post-Freddie Gray city, as the stories of people throughout the community are formed and shared. The first in a series of events called Baltimore Stories, Narratives and the Life of an American City takes place Wednesday. My first two guests this morning are leading the charge in this effort. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean at the College of Arts and Humanities in College Park and a frequent contributor to this program. Good to see you, Sherry.
Hi.
And Dr. Phoebe Stein is the executive director of the Maryland Humanities Council. Phoebe, good to see you as well.
Great to be here.
So, Sherry, this idea for this series of events that you're going to have over the next several months arose out of a thing you started a couple years ago. I attended several of them. They're really great. They're called Thinkathons.
Yes.
Tell us about a Thinkathon and how this morphed into what we're talking about this morning.
Well, in a Thinkathon, and we're actually planning the fourth one, which will happen in about 5 weeks too, is a gathering of artists and humanists and cultural workers and social activists and funders who come together for a think and do day. And so we don't populate the items, the community does. And we always have it at Westminster Hall at University of Maryland, Baltimore. It's a beautiful, sacred space, we still think. And at the end of the day, they've always been short-term and long-term outcomes that show how art and culture can be used to address the social challenges of our time. I mean, that's why we do it. And last year, it just so happened it was scheduled during the uprising, 2 days after the worst of the violence. And we stayed in place, and UMB stayed in place, and more than 120 people showed up. And this was one of the outcomes.
And remember, this is at a time that there were National Guard troops
right
on the streets down.
Yeah, it was during the uprising. So people showed up. Nobody knew who would show up. I mean, lots of people had registered, but people came that day and they worked really hard. And, you know, we had art and trauma people in place to help people think through things and feel through things because you were dredging up lots of difficult topics. And at the end of the day, there was someone from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And we knew she was there, but the idea is that you can't ask, you can't do an ask during a Thinkathon. And she stood up and said, you all should go for a public square grant. And NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, had just announced 2 days before this brand new grant that would have the humanities out in the world. And I said to the group, well, that's a really great idea. Who wants who wants to do that? And they looked back at me and said, well, you want to do that, which was true. I did want to do that. And that day, the major partners came up and said, we want in. And so Maryland Humanities Council and the Arts and Humanities Center for Synergy are the lead organizations, which is Phoebe and me.
Yeah.
But we, as you said, have major partners. There are many other partners. I mean, we will be holding, there'll be 20 events throughout the year. We'll be holding an event at MICA, at Coppin, at UB Blake, at some churches and certainly at libraries.
Yeah, and Phoebe, these are all in response to what happened last April, and this is all this is the way that folks in the humanities, folks in the arts are responding, the same way that we have the political sector responding. I mean, just last week, the Democrats in the Assembly, you know, cobbled together about a $290 mm-hmm. million dollar package of aid to the city mm-hmm. of Baltimore, includes mm-hmm. various things. I'm interested that some of the things that it includes are extended hours at the library and money for the parks, you know.
Right.
So, but this whole notion of talking about it is part of how the humanities and the arts are responding.
Absolutely. We really see our role at the Humanities Council as a convener and as an organization that can provide that space and opportunity to use the humanities to reflect, to exchange. The idea here is that history, literature, poetry, ethics, jurisprudence, right, talking about the law, can help us come together and start that conversation that can lead to solutions. So this is not job training. This is not necessarily performing arts. This is really this forum for the very important dialogue that we think needs to happen. And we see this as vitally important to moving forward. And that's really what our partnership with Sherry and the Center is about.
Yeah, and Sherry Parks, of course, your whole scholarly focus is people's narratives about what's going on in popular culture and going on, you know, politically, philosophically in our country, how we frame the stories of what happened in April of 2015 is crucially important to how we understand ourselves, isn't it?
It is. And what we noticed, several of us noticed, that during the uprising, Baltimore was having very sophisticated conversations about narrative with itself. So the students at Frederick Douglass were saying that...
That's the high school across the street from Mondawmin Hall.
Exactly. And many people assumed that the students who were, that the people that were looting were the students from the high school. And the students at Douglass said, we have to change the narrative. They used that word, about us, because that was not us. So Baltimore was having really sophisticated conversations, so it was not the role of the scholars and the artists to come in and teach Baltimore about narrative. But we did say, but we can help this conversation, and we can help how people understand how important narrative is in determining, and I don't use that word very often, determining how we think and talk about each other and how we act, and ways to make the narrative about Baltimore more inclusive and more diverse and more sophisticated, more reflective of the many voices that are here in the city.
Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. Dr. Phoebe Stein is here as well. She's the director of the Maryland Humanities Council on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. And Phoebe, of course, the whole thing about narratives, and we see this play out on the political stage all the time, is that people are always bucking to be the dominant narrative. You know, either Trump wants to have his narrative or Clinton wants to have her narrative. You're talking about making all the narratives out there, making all the stories accessible to people, because
yes,
there's a whole lot of different things to talk about.
And accessible and relevant, right? So at the Humanities Council, we want to partner with other organizations and in the community. So just as Sherry said, we're not prescribing. We're not going into a community and saying, you should be talking about this. It's the community members that are going to provide those narratives and teach us. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all going to learn from each other. I often say that we're sort of in the ambiguity business, the gray area. And I think there's a lot of merit in that, moving away from the extremes of the black and white thinking.
Mm-hmm. And Sherry, how do you see, as a scholar and as a person who just really has her ear to the ground on this stuff all the time, how the narrative is starting to evolve now, you know, almost 1 year hence from the 27th of April last year?
Well, we started with the idea that Baltimore was already a much storied city, that there are lots of stories out there about Baltimore in the media and books and magazines. Many people around the world think they know Baltimore, and so it has a role in the public imagination. So we're using that both to look at Baltimore very specifically, but then there will be a website that will use Baltimore as a metaphor to help people think about race. And because of that, we want to make sure that we examine how these extra voices that stepped up and said, wait a minute, nobody's talking about us. Nobody's listening to me. And I mean, certainly that was African Americans, but there are other voices too. The issue of social class certainly began to factor in a city where the default for Black always was poor. People assumed if you were Black, you were poor. And we began to get much more of a texture in the narratives around Baltimore in the last year.
For example, one of the things you're going to concentrate on is the role of women.
Yes.
And it's interesting how, you know, when we think back to how women's role played out in the civil rights movement in the 60s, how it's playing out now with places like, or with organizations like Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. You're going to talk about the role of music.
Yes.
So you're going to examine this from all sorts of different prisms.
Well, yes. In the previous civil rights movement, the voices of women and girls were actually suppressed. There were some, but we know now that they were suppressed. And in the uprising, the voices of women and girls were very, very prominent. And some of those people will be in some of these workshops. Notice that during the uprising, music did not play a prominent role until after the violent part, which is very unusual. Usually protests have music. And so we will look at that and then look at the roles that music plays during protest movement.
Yeah, and you can kind of wonder what might have happened had music played a role earlier in the process.
Or what might not have happened.
Or what might not have happened. All right, well, it's going to be a really fascinating series of events, and I appreciate both of you guys coming by and
talking. So happy
talking
to
about.
Be here.
Thank
okay.
you, Tom.
Good to see you. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. She's also the director of the Arts and Humanities Center for Synergy. And the author of a terrific book, by the way, called Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. And, of course, a regular contributor to Maryland Morning. Dr. Phoebe Stein is the executive director of the Maryland Humanities Council and the host of Humanities Connection, which airs here on WYPR every Thursday afternoon during All Things Considered. The Baltimore Stories series begins Wednesday morning with television producer and author David Simon and Dr. Khalil Gibran Mohammed, the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in New York. That afternoon, Dr. Christopher Bonner, an historian at the University of Maryland, will lead a discussion about what Mr. Simon and Dr. Mohammed had to say in the morning. All starts at 9 o'clock in the morning at Westminster Hall on Fayette Street in West Baltimore. I also want to mention another event sponsored by the Maryland Humanities Council that will mark the year anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray. That's at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African-American History and Culture. It's called All Baltimore Voices, Stories About and Beyond the Unrest. It takes place on April 23rd. Come to wypr.org/Maryland Morning for details on all of these events. Coming up after a break for the news, another in our continuing conversations about the impact of race in this political season, Professor Eddie Glaude Jr. from Princeton University joins me to talk about his new book, Democracy in Black. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Join in on the conversation. Go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now, another in our continuing conversations about race and politics. Eddie Glaude Jr. is a professor of religion and the chair of the African American Studies Department at Princeton University. His new book is called Democracy in Black: How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. He argues that disparities between Black and white achievement continue to grow because of the refusal of the Black political establishment to concentrate specifically on the needs of African Americans in favor of a deracialized approach approach to elective politics. He's critical of everyone from Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton to President Obama. We began our conversation by talking about the values gap that exists between white and black America. Professor Glaude, welcome to Maryland Morning.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
You talk about the value gap. How is that manifested and how is that continuing and how has it changed, you know, since the beginning of the Republic?
Part of what motivated me to write the book was trying to make sense of the disconnect between talk of economic recovery and the reality of the economic devastation that still engulfs many black communities throughout the country. Over 240,000 homes lost as a result of the crash of the housing market. Over 38% of our children are growing up in poverty now. African Americans are struggling with regards to the rental market, the job market, and we're witnessing almost an epidemic of police violence directed towards young black men and women. And so I was trying to figure out what was going on here. How can people talk about recovery and all of this devastation has happened in our communities? And I said, well, something must be going on. These people are disposable. And then from there, I got to the value gap. This belief that white people matter more than others, and to the extent to which that belief animates so much of our life world in the United States, no matter what we do, no matter what the inputs are, as long as that belief obtains the outcome, the outputs will be the same. We'll still have persistent racial inequality.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this grows out of what you write about as racial habits.
Yeah.
And we all have racial habits, regardless of our race. How do those play in? I mean, much of our conversation, you say, you know, denies the existence of racial habits.
Right.
We all, I suppose, at least a certain sector wants to think, oh, you know, I have no racism, et cetera. But we have habits, certainly.
When we think about racism as just simply intentional acts of prejudice, right, we lose sight of the ways in which habits do the work of reproducing inequality. And I like to think about those habits that we are socialized into. I tell the story in the book. My father was the second African-American man hired at the post office in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And he moved his precocious kids from the east side of Moss Point to the west side, a nice house on the hill.
A predominantly white side of town.
We crossed the tracks. Mm-hmm. And I was playing with my old Tonka truck outside with my new white neighbor. And suddenly I hear his father yell, "Stop playing with that nigger." And it was the first time I had been called that word. And this is the way we typically tell the story of American racism, right? Some black family achieves the American dream and some mean-spirited adult hurls a racial epithet at a child. And that child has to spend the rest of her life struggling to prove that she's not that. But that's too easy because, you know, that moment was just the icing on the cake. I already knew at 8 years old that we were moving to the white side of town. Because in my old neighborhood, when it rained, it flooded because the pipes were bad. The sidewalks weren't paved. The baseball diamond wasn't regularly cut. The houses were smaller. The schools weren't as good. The community was in some ways beholden to the layoff cycles of the paper mill, the Porgy plant, the Ingleship building.
Yeah, and so even as an eight-year-old, when you moved, you knew it was an upgrade.
I had mm-hmm. already been socialized in the very built environment, in the spaces. Right. We know, even here in Baltimore, right, we know that there are places that we go and places that we don't go, that the spatially race is learned and inhabited and absorbed. And so these racial habits, they evidence themselves even in our social arrangements. People aren't walking around being loud racist. They just happen to hang out with their friends and family. And when you see that, I mean, this is really cool. Social scientists at Rutgers have been talking about social networks as reproducing racial inequality. Our social networks are 75% homogeneous, and we're just helping out our friends. Nancy DiTomaso at Rutgers did a study where she interviewed all of these folks. The white interviewers from Tennessee and New Jersey. I'm telling you, these black people are lazy. They don't want to work. They just want a handout. And it turns out that one of the respondents, his dad was very close to the union boss who helped him get his son get a job. The other, interestingly enough, his friend gave him the test. Not only gave him the test, gave him the answers on the test. And so here we see not so much explicit racism, right? Just habits.
Yeah, yeah. Professor Eddie Glaude Jr., the book is called Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Folks would say, well, you know, we've certainly made progress. I mean, you know, since the 60s or since the 40s, you know, when the civil rights movement began, we have a black president.
Yeah.
And you say, you're pretty tough on President Obama. You say that he sold us the snake oil of hope and change. And your critique of black politics in America is really quite astute and harsh. So what does it mean that as a black president, he has, to a certain extent, to a large extent, perhaps, disappointed African-Americans and let down the country in the process?
Well, you know, I think some people aren't disappointed because they didn't have the expectation that he would actually have the power to transform the circumstances of race in this country. And so, you know, I call Obama, President Obama, a kind of Melvillian confidence man, right, selling the snake oil of hope and change, because I don't think he was aggressive enough in trying to challenge the frame. And so part of what I'm arguing in the book is that you have a black political class that is in some ways capitulated to the frame. And what
I want to make sure, does the frame include, for example, Mr. Obama's calculation or assertion that we're not red states, we're not blue states, we're the United States? In what way did his obligation or opportunity to the black community differ from his opportunity
right.
and obligation to the wider community?
Well, there's this wonderful line in James Baldwin's The Notes of a Native Son, and I'm paraphrasing here. It says that we have to become blank to wash away the guilt, the sins of the nation. In some ways, there's this sense in which the particularity of who we are kind of gets left aside, and some universal notion of the American stands in. And typically that universal notion is white, right? Everybody else has to stop being who they are while white people get to be who they are, right? And so all the advantages that have accrued because of the value gap, right? It becomes difficult to name it, right? To resist it. When you start with that frame, right? So what does it mean that the policy to address the housing crisis did not take into consideration how fundamentally racist, right, predatory lending has been? What do we do with the failure of really thinking about the history of a dual labor market and how that has impacted where we find ourselves in the current job market?
But hasn't his approach been that the rising tide lifts all boats?
As
the economy gets better, it gets better for everybody, because you're arguing that it hasn't.
That lift all boats is FDR's response to African-American communities as he's negotiating and compromising with the Dixiecrats of the South. That very language has a kind of political history that we have to unpack, because it's in some ways a kind of capitulation to the pressures of those who want to maintain Jim Crow. So to invoke it in the context of today is in some ways, again, President Obama navigating the forces. And the book is not about critiquing President Obama. It's really talking about these last 8 years. And so part of what I've been arguing and what I argue in the book is that we've had a kind of narrowing of black political discourse, where in some ways it's just been an argument among black liberals, whether it's traditional liberals of Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and Maxine Waters, or the post-black liberals like my good friend Cory Booker, who blurbed the book, or President Obama, right? And so you get this very narrow range of argument. And when you think about it, there was once a time when, to invoke Mao, there were 1,000 flowers bloomed. There was kind of a radical tradition that pushed African-American politics, right? In some ways, what we've witnessed over the last generation is an all-out assault on that tradition.
So, you know, you talk about the Baldwin quote and
yeah.
the term blanking. You call for something that's incredibly radical here. I mean, we are talking about a political process. You're
yeah.
calling for an election blankout
right.
where people vote in bigger numbers than ever before, hopefully, and they vote for the down-ticket races, Congress, Senate, local races, but they leave the presidential box blank.
Right.
I mean, elections are about choices.
Yeah.
And as disappointing as anybody might be with President Obama, the choice was President Obama or Mitt Romney, or then Senator Obama and John McCain. I mean, those were the choices.
Yeah.
And to
yeah.
leave it blank is essentially voting for the other side, is it not?
Not necessarily. You know, I used the two examples, one from fiction and one from actual political politics. The first example comes from José Saramago, one of my favorite novelists. He wrote a novel entitled Seeing. And the basis of the plot is a major election, and the electorate turns out in massive numbers, and they count the ballots, and 80% of them are blank. They call them blankers. And then they said something must have happened, and they do it again, and the same thing happens again. And so what the voters did was use the electoral process to say that these choices are not our choice. And then I used the example.
But you couldn't have an election in which nobody wins. Somebody wins.
Right. The point of the allegory is that it threw the system into disarray, right? And what I say is we have to figure out how are we going to create a civic power outage so that we can reboot our relationship to the democratic process. Because the Democratic Party takes black voters for granted, right? So every 2, 4, 8 years, they come to our communities, they try to deliver us to the polls, and then they have no intention on actually delivering policy. And we've seen that, particularly ever since the DLC took over, right? Ever since the New Democrat came into power, right? And I don't want a fifth term of Clinton, right? to be clear. And then you have a black political class that in some ways acquires its power by delivering black voters for the Democratic Party. So how do we short circuit that so that we can create a much more vibrant deliberative space for black folk to engage in the political process? And so the second example, real example, is the 1998 plebiscite in Puerto Rico. There are these choices about do we become a Commonwealth, do we not, da-da-da. And so then there was a massive campaign to write in none of the above, and none of the above won. Unless the Democratic Party, right, and we see Bernie Sanders pushing the Democratic Party more and more to the left, and if unless we open up space so there can be actual policies to address double-digit unemployment, to address the crisis of public education, to address, right, mass incarceration or criminal justice, unless they do it specifically, African Americans should turn out in massive numbers, right, and vote down ballot, because that's where all the innovation is going anyway, because they've been starving the beast for generations.
But isn't that a huge, huge risk? Because as much as you might not want a fifth term of Clinton, would you want a first term of Trump?
So then that's the question that you have to ask the Democratic Party. None of this would matter. The blank out campaign wouldn't matter if the Democratic Party would just simply stand on actual policies that would respond to the conditions of black communities. So if the Democratic Party refuses to do it, why should black voters bear the burden of holding back the fascist tendencies of the Republican Party? When in fact, what that would mean is that the Democratic Party leadership has chosen a Republican to win the presidency.
Because it's so interesting that the argument on the Republican side seems to be exactly the same thing in reverse, in that some of them are saying, let's go ahead and lose this election should Trump be the nominee. It's horrible enough to have Trump the nominee if mm-hmm. that's what happens, and it would be horrible to have him as the president. It'd be better to have a Clinton or even a Sanders as the president for a while. It gives us a chance to regroup.
Right.
Would you suggest the same thing on the Democratic side? Risk losing the presidency to someone like Trump as a way of, you know, sending such a strong message and regrouping the down ballot in the Senate and the Congress?
Well, I think this is something that we have to think about. I think part of what I've been trying to do across the country, we've put the books in the hands of organizers because, you know, we have been organizing for a while. Folks forget about WTO in Seattle. Folks forget about the anti-war mobilization before under the Bush years. Obama became the kind of object of that grassroots mobilization. We got kind of lost our way, and then Occupy showed up, and then Black Lives Matter showed up. There's a lot of organizing going on the ground in local communities. And so they're thinking, and remember, voting is actually the last thing we're supposed to do in a democracy. Politics is much more than electoral cycles. And so when we begin to think about politics in a much more expansive way, we can begin to make some choices. And so I want to suggest, and this is what I'm saying to my fellow white progressives and white centrists, right? And I keep asking the question, what are you going to do to speak to why, to our condition, so that we can do this right?
Professor Eddie Glaude, I really appreciate it. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been wonderful.
Professor Eddie Glaude Jr. is the William S. Todd Professor of Religion and the Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. The book is called Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. We've got more on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up later in the program, WYPR's Sheila Cass talks to the best-selling author John Irving. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. The Single Carrot Theater in Baltimore has created a new play called Something Like Jazz Music. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to see it, and she's here with this review.
In 1995, a worker at a recently closed New York State mental institution discovered what became known as the Willard suitcases, more than 400 suitcases still packed with the belongings of former patients dating back to 1910. These suitcases became the inspiration for Single Carrot Theater's latest ensemble-created work, Something Like Jazz Music. Instead of a mental hospital, however, the action takes place in a Baltimore shipping warehouse after a mysterious, undocumented container shows up. When it's opened, raucous jazz pours out. The workers remove the contents, luggage, steamer trunks, a dresser. As they try on a hat or a piece of clothing, they're transported back, at times with a physical jolt, to 1920s Baltimore. There, they find themselves transformed into everyone from an African-American jazz musician to a Jewish doctor to a Ku Klux Klansman. The warehouse employee's confusion, awareness, or total absorption varies. In an early scene, actor Paul Diem's modern character is mystified to suddenly become a 1920s cop. Meanwhile, Nancy Linden's warehouse manager now fully embodies a fun-loving flapper.
You new in town?
Huh?
You new? I haven't seen you in this joint before.
Karen, I've worked here for 3 years.
Karen? You got the wrong gal, pal. Don't pretend like you haven't heard about me. I know what everyone in here says about Mrs. Beth Walker.
To further complicate matters, the warehouse personnel frequently morph into more than one character. In one case, Paul Diem vies for a different part, that of a tough jazz club owner named Wallace. It's a part that's already been inhabited by two other actors, Samuel DeMarque Wright and Christopher Dues.
Hey guys, can I try out Wallace? You know, just try him out. You guys get to try him out. Can I try him out and see what it's like to be the boss?
Walter, Wallace is black.
What? How do you know?
The modern character's acknowledgement that they are playing roles is a meta-theatrical strain that runs throughout the play. When a gun appears, Nancy Linden's character comments, "It's not supposed to be in this story." Along with these self-referential touches, there are a number of single-carat hallmarks, the smooth integration of music, lighting, and projections, movement so fluid it borders on choreography, and a tone that mixes playfulness with seriousness. But the tight ensemble work is single-carat's strongest hallmark. It applies not only to the six-member cast, but also to the way the show was created. A team of 11 devised the work. Then Genevieve DeMai created a script, and Alex Fenhagen and Stephen Kriegel co-directed the production. Structurally, the show would benefit from a little more shaping. It starts with the workers in the warehouse doing regimented moves that represent warehouse tasks. It ends with Christopher Dues performing a disturbing kind of puppet show with a minstrel mask and a Ku Klux Klan hood, items found in one of the suitcases. The gifted Dues then recites Langston Hughes's Dream Variations. This character has learned something from his time travel, but it's difficult to tell if his co-workers have. It would be eye-opening to see if the employee's initial regimentation has changed at the end. The title, Something Like Jazz Music, comes from a bit of dialogue. The words something like are critical. Even if we could travel back in time, we wouldn't get a complete, unvarnished portrait. Theater, however, can improve on that. Something Like Jazz Music makes strides. It's packed with striking inventions, some, no doubt, the result of jazz-like improvisation. But at this point, they don't quite add up to a satisfying composition.
Something Like Jazz Music is at the Single Carat Theater in Baltimore until Sunday. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning for more about showtimes and tickets. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews all things thespian every Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. After a break for news, the novelist John Irving talks with Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
Oh boy, what a dance I saw down yonder in Baltimore, done to a brand new tune. In most every cabaret, from D.C. to Frisco Bay, they'll all be doing it soon. There's a dance called a black flag called Baltimore. Oh baby, that's...
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In a half century of remarkable work, the writer John Irving has produced 14 novels, including The World According to Garp, The Hotel New Hampshire, and most recently, Avenue of Mysteries. He's also written a children's book, two memoirs, an essay collection, and several screenplays. In 2000, he took home the Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar for The Cider House Rules. He's been a Pulitzer Prize finalist and was three times nominated for a National Book Award, winning one in 1980 for GARP. John Irving will be in Baltimore tomorrow night for the Baltimore Speakers Series presented by Stevenson University. The event will be moderated by WIPR's Sheila Cast, who last week spoke by phone with John Irving from his home in Toronto, Canada.
You call yourself an old-fashioned novelist. Explain that.
Well, that for the most part means that my models as a young writer, the writers I read who made me wish I could do it, who made me want to be a writer, were already old-fashioned when I was a kid. They were those novelists of the 19th century, Dickens, Hardy, Melville, Hawthorne, for the most part, long plotted novels in which the passage of time often plays a major minor role, character-driven stories. There was nothing in the modern or contemporary landscape of literature that attracted me. I grew up around a small town theater. I was interested in acting, stage acting, theater acting, before I was old enough to read those 19th century novels, which are not easy reads. But I sort of left my love for the theater behind and became captivated in my early teens with that 19th century novel. So certainly in the sense of what got me started as a writer, what interested me in becoming a writer, I was kind of old-fashioned before I started.
You are famous for writing the last sentence of your novels first, which implies, at least to me, implies to me that you have done enormous research, thinking, and plotting before you actually write. So how many writing projects do you have underway?
Once I begin writing a novel, I never am writing more than one novel at a time. But my novels wait a long time to be written, usually twice as long as it will take me to write them once I start. And once I start writing a novel, once I'm actually writing a novel, I normally take 5 or 6 years, sometimes as long as 7, once as short a time as 3. But it's common for books to simply gather information, gather material, gather research, character sketches, storylines, a kind of street map of the novel I want to write. It's common for novels to accumulate all this information, notes, for 10 or 20 years before I undertake actually writing it. That's not unusual. So there usually are 2 or 3 novels and 2 or 3 screenplays that are in partial formation. Things I'm not writing, but I'm thinking about and I'm contributing notes to. I'm learning more about them. It's just the way I've always worked. I get last sentences first. I see where stories end before I make a decision about where you, the reader, should enter the story. I don't know where a story begins until I already know where it ends. And I write more than last sentences before I start. The last sentences now over all these novels, the last sentence has never changed, not even a comma. But generally from that last sentence, I can work in a backward direction and compose the last 4 or 5 paragraphs, so that I'm writing not only toward what happens at the end of a story, I know how it sounds. I know how my voice sounds at the end of the story, what the tone of voice is. That somehow means a lot to me, to be able to hear what the voice of the end of the story is and know that's how I'm supposed to sound when I get there, because you don't want to sound that way too soon.
That's novelist John Irving here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. John Irving is speaking here tomorrow in the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. You mentioned a few minutes ago the importance of respecting the impact of the passage of time on the characters. You yourself just turned 74. How would you describe the impact of time on you as a novelist?
I don't feel much affected by it as a novelist. The fact that, like any like any former athlete, I did compete as a wrestler for 20 years. You know, I'm certainly aware of that wear and tear. I'm certainly aware of the limitations of my body, but I've not yet encountered any change in my working habits or my perspective on writing a novel or how to write a novel. If anything, I guess I'm more patient, but I've always been very slowly moving as a writer. I write in longhand as a way of even slowing down the first draft process, as a way of being careful or moving slowly. I spend many more years waiting to begin a novel than I do to write it once I begin. That's just always been a part of my process. But if anything, over time, since the late 60s when I published my first novel, if anything over time has changed, I guess it's a willingness to move even more deliberately. I don't rush things. My wife and my children they sometimes get impatient with me because I start a sentence and leave them waiting. And they look at me with some exasperation, and I say, I'm thinking. And they just roll their eyes. They know they could get up and go to the bathroom and come back, and I might still be sitting there. You know? So it's okay.
We are almost out of time, but one last question. As a storyteller, what do you make of the presidential campaign that's going on?
I hate to say that an election which at this phase seems as chaotic and extreme as this one was just bizarre, but I think what we see in this election, in its process, is very much a reflection of how troubled and disturbed the United States is. And that's what we're seeing. It's easy to point the finger at all of these clowns collectively and say, well, there's someone better. But I'm venturing to say that these people, however much or how many of them are embarrassing, these people seem to me to be reflecting the truly disturbing and chaotic divides among us. There's a lot of them.
The novelist John Irving speaking last week from Toronto with WIPR's Sheila Cast. Sheila will be the moderator at John Irving's appearance tomorrow night on the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University at the Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday on Maryland Morning, a survey of Maryland's hotly contested congressional races, a historical look at Maryland's elections, and rock bands at the BSO. I hope you'll join us. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac.